Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast, and this is our first episode of 2023. Happy New Year. I'm Jamie, here with John.
Happy New Year's, guys. Man, I'm excited for 2023. I hope you guys are going to have the best year ever, and I hope True Crime Cast can meet your true crime podcast needs.
Yeah, hoping to have the best year ever for our podcast as well. Got some exciting things coming in the next few months, so we'll share those as they come available, but more than anything, we're just thankful. We like to end each year being thankful. Just be thankful every day.
We don't have any Patreon members to thank this week. We're trying to record as many of these as we can with our holiday travel schedule. But when we get back from vacation, I'm sure we'll have some Patreon members to thank.
We do have some reviews that I've saved for this episode. This one comes over on Facebook from Holly Keith. Yeah, buddy. This one's on my weekly rotation. These guys make a dynamic duo. They have great cases, deep dives into the facts, and are very tasteful and respectful in their presentation. I've only got good things to say about it. Go ahead, y'all. Add it to your weekly playlist. You'll be glad you did. Thank you so much for the kind words, Holly. This one comes from AppleEck1 over on Apple Podcasts. Best True Crime Podcast. With so many of the true crime podcasts using vulgar language, True Crime Cast is so much more pleasant to listen to. I also enjoy their 10-minute podcasts. Keep up the good work. Thank you so much for that, AppleEck. And finally, this one comes from Clicky123. Best crime podcast out there. True Crime Cast truly is the best crime podcast out there. The narration is informative yet entertaining. The banter is funny but still respectful. I like how both Jamie and John have significant roles and take turns rather than one of them hijacking the story and letting the other give feedback. Also, while they do have accents, they're definitely tolerable. That's what we're shooting for.
That's what my wife says about me is I'm tolerable.
I've even got my boyfriend hooked. 10 out of 10 recommend. P.S. Hi, John and Jamie. Thank you, Clicky123.
Clickety click. Thank you very much. I just did my best True Crime All the Time Gibby there.
That was good.
Yeah.
Well played. I think that was a good reference that was made timely. Thank you to all those leaving reviews. Again, we'll continue to read those 5-star reviews over on Apple Podcasts or anywhere on social media you choose to leave them. Just tag us.
We have covered a lot of serial killers, I feel like, lately, but we definitely have one more to start off 2023.
I was doing some research for this, and I started thinking, I feel like in the 1970s in California, you're more likely to die from a serial killer than in a variety of normal ways to die.
Were you able to research like the odds or?
I didn't find any odds, but there were more than 20 serial killers in California in the 70s and 80s, and many of them operating over the course of both decades. I know California is a big state. Obviously, most of these were in the big cities around LA, around the Bay Area. Just so, I don't know, maybe just the population was so big, killers moved there to do it. Maybe the odds based on population or that they ended up out there. I don't know, but the numbers are shocking how many people were out there killing a bunch of people, but also how many people died at the hands of serial killers during those two decades.
Yeah, add that to the many, many things or reasons why I would never go to California.
Yeah.
But I would travel to like Northern California. Especially to see the redwoods, man. That would be great.
I've been to California a couple times. Haven't been killed, so I got that going for me. Maybe my luck's just run out, though. Maybe I won't go back.
Where have you been? I know you've been to San Diego.
I've been to the Bay Area for work and gone to some baseball games and done some fun stuff out there. Yeah, I really enjoyed the San Diego area.
I feel like you need to mention honeymoon.
In San Diego. We went to San Diego on our honeymoon.
You didn't say that, though. I felt like you needed to say that.
Yeah, it was on our honeymoon. It was many, many years ago.
Not our honeymoon.
I think
you and your wife's honeymoon.
I think it was the one week in the past 20 years that San Diego was cloudy and cold. So it was great. Thanks, California.
Why don't we start talking about murder? before you're murdered by your wife.
That sounds great, man. Get us rolling.
Around 1 o'clock in the morning on May 14th, 1983, there was a California Highway Patrol officer who spotted a Toyota Celica driving wildly on Interstate 5 in Orange County. Random side note here, my buddy had a Toyota Celica and I loved it. It was a 90s model though, not an 83.
Yeah.
So officers suspected the driver was intoxicated, so they pulled the Toyota over. And as the driver got out of the car, he poured out the contents of a beer bottle onto the sidewalk and his jeans were unbuttoned. They gave the man a field sobriety test and he failed. The man was put under arrest. And when the officer approached the car, he saw a young man slumped over in the passenger seat. His eyes were closed and he was partially covered by a jacket. And there were several empty beer bottles and a prescription bottle for lorazepam at his feet.
The officer attempted to wake the young man by shaking his arm, but when he touched the sleeping passenger, he noticed that his skin was oddly cold. He checked for a pulse and realized that the man did not have a pulse. He was dead, and he had a ligature mark around his neck. When they removed the jacket from the victim's lap, they discovered that his pants had been opened and his hands were tied with a shoelace. He had been tied and strangled to death. The victim was Terry Lee Gambrell, a 25-year-old Marine from the El Toro Air Base. Officers charged the driver immediately with driving under the influence and held him in custody for questioning so they could search the vehicle and get more evidence to figure out how this young man was murdered.
So when they searched the car, and in the back of the car, police found a belt the width of the ligature marks around Terry's neck. There was also alcohol, tranquilizers, prescription drugs, and stimulants. The passenger seat and carpet were bloodstained, which was weird because Terry didn't have any open wounds. When they tested the blood, it was found to be human. Under the carpet, police found an envelope with more than 50 photographs of young men in pornographic positions. They all appeared to be unconscious or dead. In the trunk, authorities found the most disturbing thing, a coded handwritten list. So the list, referred to as the scorecard, had 61 neatly printed terms and phrases written on it. It is believed to be a murdered list belonging to the driver, Randy Kraft.
Which is where he gets his name, the scorecard killer. There were so many serial killers again at this time in California that naming them became pretty popular thing, mostly for journalists to do, and Randy Kraft was dubbed the scorecard killer. Let's learn some more about Randy Kraft. He was born in Long Beach, California on March 19th of 1945. He was the fourth child of Opal and Harold Kraft. His father was emotionally withdrawn, but his mother, by all accounts, seemed to be very involved as a parent. She was active in Randy's childhood. She served on the PTA at his school. Teachers praised Kraft for his intelligence, and he was invited to attend accelerated classes for gifted children. While he was in high school, Kraft was thought to be a pretty normal kid. He was a member of the Boy Scouts. He was part of the school's debate team. He founded a World Affairs Club, and he dreamed of being a U.S. senator. It was at this time in his life that Kraft also realized that he was gay, but he kept that secret from his family and friends and did not come out at the time. He graduated 10th in his class and enrolled in Claremont Men's College. During his enrollment there, he joined the Reserve Officers Training Corps, also known as the ROTC. He attended pro-Vietnam War rallies and campaigned for Barry Goldwater. But by his second year, he claimed to have abandoned his conservative ideology. And it was that same year that he started his first homosexual relationship. He had been working as a bartender at a local gay bar and took male friends home to his family, who continued to pretend they didn't know about Kraft's sexuality, but it became obvious to them that he was gay.
In 1967, Kraft became a political organizer for the Democratic Party and campaigned for Robert F. Kennedy. It's pretty amazing, right? Like, that's a huge opportunity.
It really is, and it's something that a lot of people that want to get into politics doing things like this is how you really get started and make a name for yourself.
By his senior year, Kraft cared less and less about school. He was drinking. He was doing drugs. He was regularly going to all-night poker games. He ended up failing to graduate on time because of one class he had had to repeat. So he didn't graduate until February of 1968.
After school, Kraft went on to join the Air Force. He quickly rose in the ranks to American First Class and a supervisor manager. The year he became American First Class, he finally came out and told his family about his sexuality. Kraft described his mother as being understanding, but his father flew into a rage. Again, his father was pretty emotionally disengaged, so this was the first time he had really gotten a reaction out of his father for anything. But eventually the family said they accepted Kraft's homosexuality, but his sisters noted that he started distancing himself from the family around this same time. He also came out to his supervisors, and on July 26 of 1969, he received a discharge on medical grounds. This was a time when homosexuality was not accepted at all in the military, and they found a way to get him out of the Air Force. He sought legal advice on trying to challenge this, and especially the grounds of the discharge, which were completely made up, but the Air Force never backed down and changed it. He would eventually move back in with his parents, and he got a job once again as a bartender.
Randy Kraft was almost caught once. In March of 1970, 13-year-old Joseph Francher ran away from home in Huntington Beach, where Kraft lived. Joseph ran into Kraft, who drugged him and kidnapped him. Kraft showed him an explicit photo of men before raping him. Joseph managed to escape when Kraft left for work, stumbling into a bar bloody and disoriented. Man, could you imagine 13 years old and this is happening to you? Just awful, awful stuff.
And to be in that bar when he runs in and to see what he's been through is just tragic to try to help this young man.
The bar patrons rushed him to the ER where his stomach was pumped. At the hospital, Joseph told the police that Kraft had given him drugs and beat him. He didn't tell them about the rape because he was so embarrassed about it and he didn't think they would believe him. Joseph took authorities back to Kraft's home where they searched the room with the cooperation of his roommate. Unfortunately, because police searched Kraft's homes without a warrant, most of the evidence was thrown out and Kraft was able to walk away.
And again, this was something that was really common at the time and continues to be common, is that people are embarrassed and sometimes think they're going to be blamed if they're assaulted or raped. So this is why Joseph didn't tell, and that continues to be a reason that some people don't come forward about being raped today. From 1971 to 1983, Kraft is believed to have killed potentially 67 men who were between the ages of 13 and 35. John, that is a lot of victims.
It is unbelievable.
We don't have time to go over each and every potential victim, but when we get back from the break, we will go over some so you can get a gist about how awful this man was. Randy Kraft's first suspected victim was Wayne Duquette, who was a bartender at a local gay bar called Stables. Police found the 30-year-old's body off of the Ortega Highway on October 5th of 1971. By the time Wayne's body was found, he was so decomposed that any signs of foul play couldn't be detected. His death was ruled as alcohol poisoning, which, as we know, Kraft provides alcohol and drugs to his victims. And he would later be linked to Kraft when the first entry of the scorecard read Stable. So he's giving code names to his victims in this scorecard he's keeping of the people that he murders.
A little over a year after Wayne was killed, Kraft killed 20-year-old Marine named Edward Daniel Moore. Edward was last seen leaving the barracks at Camp Pendleton on Christmas Eve of 1972. His body was found beside the 405 freeway in Seal Beach 2 days later. His injuries indicated that he had been pushed from a moving vehicle. His autopsy also showed that he had been bound at the wrists and ankles, then beaten with a blunt instrument, then strangled. So this is, I mean, I consider this torture. You know, he was bound and beaten. He also had numerous bite marks, and a sock had been forced into his rectum.
And that's going to be something that we see for a number of Kraft's victims. And that is such an odd trademark or signature for a killer that I don't think we've seen before. I'm very thankful for the name of the Scorecard Killer, because if they chose to use this act for his nickname, it would have been much more grotesque. In April of 1973, 17-year-old Kevin Clark Bailey was found beside a road in Huntington Beach. Kevin had been emasculated and sodomized. By the end of July, they would find two more victims' bodies. 20-year-old Ronnie Jean Wiebe was found strangled beside an off-ramp on the 405 highway. He had welt marks on his wrists and ankles, showing that he had been bound, and he had been suspended, probably hung upside down before he was eventually murdered. So you mentioned torture. This isn't just about raping and killing somebody. There's so much more to this power dynamic and the abuse that Kraft inflicts on his victims before he ends their lives. It's really gross.
He was known to have killed at least one more time in 1973. That would be Vincent Cruz Mestes, who was a 23-year-old art student whose body was found in the San Bernardino Mountains on December 29th of 1973. Now, he was also found with socks in his rectum, but his hands had been cut off and have never been found.
It's almost as if Kraft is experimenting at this point for what do I like to do? How am I going to do this? Trying new things as he continues to refine the way that he abuses and kills these victims. And there's just so much evil in reflecting on what he did with these people's bodies, just ignoring that they're actual humans. Through 1974, there were five more victims that were found near major roadways in Southern California. Three of them were linked to the same killer during the investigation. Malcolm Little and James Reeves were found beside a highway with foreign objects once again inserted into their bodies. The third victim, who is a Marine, Roger Dickerson, was found with bite marks like earlier victims. So we're getting everything from mutilation with bite marks, cutting off body parts, and inserting foreign objects into people's bodies. Just so much desecration here.
And I mean, like, police have to know that this is the work of one man, right? I mean, they found all these people with almost identical wounds and, you know, the things inserted into their bodies. Like, they have to know that they're dealing with a lunatic and it's one person.
Well, they were kind of spread out. And again, there were so many serial killers active at this point that you almost have to give it a little more time in order to figure out which victims belong together, unfortunately. But you're right. There are so many common characteristics here that, especially in retrospect, we can see that this had to be the same person.
On January 3rd, 1975, Kraft kidnapped and murdered a 17-year-old named John Larras. He was last seen getting on a bus in Long Beach. His body was found the next day at Sunset Beach, and he had been strangled to death. There were drag marks along the beach, which suggested two individuals may have carried John to the water. Just 2 weeks later, 21-year-old Craig Jonitas was found in a parking lot in the Golden Sales Hotel near the Pacific Coast Highway. He had been strangled to death, likely with a shoelace.
We see strangulation being a common occurrence here as well, but we see different items being used for that strangulation. And you wonder how methodical was Kraft in these. Did he take a kill kit with him, or did he just use whatever the person had on their body to strangle them, whether that was a belt or a shoelace? At this point, there were 14 victims across four different counties in California. Again, why some of them weren't linked together initially. They had all been white men with very similar characteristics. Investigators from several jurisdictions met in Orange County to discuss this case and to get all on the same page, to share information and try to figure out who was committing these crimes. An FBI profiler said the killer had to be a person with above average intelligence who was meticulous and organized. They also said the killer probably received military training, but they didn't have a suspect in mind that met this MO immediately. But looking back, it definitely fits who we know Kraft to be.
On March 29th, 1975, Kraft lured two teenagers, Keith Cottrell and Kent May, from a Long Beach parking lot into his Ford Mustang. He gave them Valium and drove them around the Belmont Shore and Seal Beach. As the boys got into the car, two of their friends saw them getting into the distinctive black and white Mustang. That's when they say the driver leaned over and pushed the unconscious Kent out onto the pavement. As the driver sped away from the scene, the friend said Keith was slumped against the driver's shoulder. Months later, Keith's skull was found on a jetty close to Long Beach. The rest of his body was found 6 months later. After hearing the news, the friends searched their neighborhood for the Mustang. They found it less than a mile from their home. They wrote down the license plate and took that to the police. The vehicle belonged to none other than Randy Kraft.
And kudos to this group of friends for following up and chasing this lead down to find who the driver of this Mustang was. I couldn't imagine seeing your friends get abducted. And while I've certainly lost friends in my lifetime, it's never been to anything like this. Long Beach Police Department did follow up with Kraft, and they questioned him about Keith's kidnapping and murder. At first, he denied ever meeting either of the boys. Upon further questioning, he admitted that he had met the boys in the parking lot. He said he persuaded them to get in his car, to drink, and take the Valium as he drove them around.
When your story changes from, I don't know them, to, oh yes, I did meet them and interacted with them, suspicious, right?
Yeah, you're guilty of something. Obviously, he's trying to confess here to giving them, to drugging them, but I think he's going to still try to get away without saying that he killed them. Now, Kraft claimed that he took Kent to the parking lot and dropped him off and then drove Keith to a road close to El Toro off-ramp where his car got stuck in an embankment. He says he went to a gas station to call a tow truck and left Keith in the car. But when he got back, Keith was gone and he had not seen him since, implying that either somebody picked Keith up or he left on his own will and that led to his death.
Police were able to check with Kraft's roommate, and he confirmed Kraft did call that day to say his car was stuck, but they were still pretty skeptical of this story. They tried to file homicide charges against Kraft, but the LADA declined, saying the coroner's conclusion was that Keith died of accidental drowning.
This investigation, plus some relationship issues, made Kraft take a break from killing in the summer of 1975. He didn't kill for about 6 months. Often when we look at killers, they escalate. There's rarely a break unless something comes up. And obviously this investigation did cause Kraft to step back for a bit. When we get to December of 1975, Kraft resumed his old ways and kidnapped 22-year-old Mark Hall in San Juan Capistrano. Mark was driven to a remote canyon where he was tied to a tree. An autopsy would eventually show that he died of asphyxiation caused by leaves and dirt that had been stuffed down his throat. Like many of the other victims, he had been sodomized, emasculated, and he had been burned with a car cigarette lighter, which was also used on his eyes.
God, man, this is brutal stuff.
He also had numerous incisions in his legs, inflicted with a broken glass bottle. Forensics experts were able to determine that for most of this torture, when his body was being burned and cut, he was still alive to experience it.
Man, we've covered some sick cases, but dude, like, this torture is awful, man.
It is, and for most individuals that we see on sprees like this, it's more about the power of the sexual assault and somebody leaving or seeing somebody's life leave their body. And we don't always see this type of torture, but
what the crap happened to this guy? You know,
that's the thing. We don't know that a lot happened. His dad was a little removed from his life growing up. He had a very active mom. He seemed to have a normal childhood. He had goals. But this is one of those where we can't look back and say, oh, people should have seen this coming.
Yeah, man. All right. So the next part of this story. So Kraft met a new man and his focus was on this new relationship. And that led to kind of a pause to his murderous needs. He didn't kill again until December 10th, 1976. That body has never been found, but the name of that person is Paul Fuchs, and that name is clearly listed on Kraft's scorecard. Then on April 16th, 1978, Kraft kidnapped 18-year-old Marine Scott Hughes. Kraft gave Scott Valium, and then, dude, this is awful, he mutilated Scott's genitalia and strangled him to death. He disposed of his clothed boy beside a freeway ramp in Anaheim. 2 months later, the body of 23-year-old Ronald Gerald Young was found near the San Diego freeway. He had also been emasculated before being stabbed to death. Injuries indicate that he had been pushed from a vehicle traveling at high speed.
Just 8 days later, again with the escalation of more and more victims, the body of 20-year-old Marine Richard Keith was found beside a road on Moulton Parkway. Richard was last seen by his girlfriend in Carson City, but when he was found, welts indicated that he had been bound and, like many of the other victims, been strangled. He was believed to have been Marine Carson on Kraft's scorecard.
Again, like, most of these guys are Marines. When, at what point do you be like, all right, we've got a theory or a pattern here. Like, yeah. What's up with this?
Lots of Marines.
Kraft killed several more men in 1978, but in June of 1979, he kidnapped and killed 20-year-old Marine Donnie Harold Kreisel. Donnie was also thrown from a vehicle and found on the 405 freeway. The cause of death for this man was acute alcohol poisoning, but he had rope and burn marks, which indicated that he had also been bound and tortured. 2 months later, 21-year-old English tourist Keith Jackson was found dismembered and discarded in two trash bags and a cardboard box behind a gas station in Long Beach. This guy has no regard for humanity at all.
Yeah, there are some commonalities here. We see lots of drugging with alcohol, with Valium. We see hands and feet being bound. We see strangulation and emasculation. But other than that, it's like he takes a different torture approach with each victim. Sometimes it's burning. Sometimes it's cutting. Sometimes it's removing pieces of their body or shoving things inside their body. It's just like he enjoys inflicting pain, which is absolutely disgusting.
So when this guy was found, he had a sock in his rectum as well, but only his head, torso, and left leg were ever found. Kraft had an entry on his scorecard saying England and one saying 76, which could refer to Keith.
2 weeks later, 19-year-old Gregory Jolly was found in Lake Arrowhead. He had been emasculated, and his head and legs had been severed post-mortem. His possessions were found in Kraft's home, obviously confirming that he was a victim of Kraft's. On November 24th of 1979, it's believed that Kraft abducted and murdered 15-year-old Jeffrey Sayer. He was last seen at a bus stop coming home from a date with his girlfriend. Kraft had a scorecard entry that we believe referred to Sayer, reading Westminster date.
In the summer of 1980, Kraft traveled to Oregon for some business. He lived near Portland and is believed to have killed two more victims at this time, 17-year-old Denver native Michael O'Fallon and an unidentified man found on a freeway in the city of Woodburn. Kraft's scorecard had an entry reading Portland, Denver, and Michael's camera was later found in Kraft's garage. The scorecard also read Portland Elk, possibly referring to the unidentified man. 1 month later, Kraft returned to California. 19-year-old Marine Robert Loggins was found in a trash bag close to the El Toro Marine Air Base. Photos found in Kraft's home later showed Robert in Kraft's living room, slumped on his sofa, apparently intoxicated, and in various nude pornographic poses. His eyes were always closed, so it's unknown if he was alive when these photos were taken or if he was actually dead in these pictures.
Over 1982, Kraft killed another six men before moving to Grand Rapids, Michigan for a short time on business. He had only been there 2 days when he met cousins Dennis Ault and Christopher Schoenburn at a seminary in the Amway Grand Plaza Hotel. Kraft was seen talking to the men at the hotel's reception shortly before midnight. On December 9th, the two men were found in an open field close to the hotel. They were laying in the field face up, one of them was naked, and the other was shoeless without a coat. Drag marks made it clear that they had been dumped there and had not walked there on their own and died. 24-year-old Dennis had suffocated, and his 20-year-old cousin, Chris, had been strangled to death with a belt. Chris's mom described them as hardworking farm boys totally dedicated to the lifestyle they had grown up in. The scorecard had an entry reading GR2, which is believed to stand for the Grand Rapids 2.
On December 8th, Kraft was back to Portland, and within 24 hours, he had killed 19-year-old hitchhiker Lance Taggs. He was discovered along a Royal Road in Clackamas County, close to where another one of Kraft's victims had been found just 2 weeks earlier. Lance had Valium and alcohol in his system. He had been strangled and had a sock stuffed in his throat. A few weeks later, he abducted 21-year-old hitchhiker Eric Church. Eric was last seen hitchhiking from Orange County to Sacramento. His body was found along I-605. An autopsy showed that Church had consumed alcohol and Valium, and he had been sodomized. Rope marks show that he had struggled against his restraints before he died of strangulation and numerous blows to the head.
On February 12, 1983, Kraft killed two men in Buena Park. 18-year-old Jeffrey Nelson and 20-year-old Roger Duvall were last seen outside the house of a friend shortly after midnight. They told their friend that they were going to go get something to eat. When they were found, Jeffrey was nude and murdered by the side of an off-ramp close to Garden Grove Freeway. He had been emasculated, strangled, and thrown from a moving vehicle. Roger's body was found the next day on a mountainside in San Bernardo County. He had been bound, sodomized, and strangled with a cord.
All right, so after Kraft was arrested for reckless driving, upon further investigation, he was charged with several counts of homicide. His trial started in September of 1988. Dude, there were 160 witnesses called to testify, and over 1,000 exhibits were entered into evidence. The trial lasted 13 months. Could you imagine, like, a year of your life on a jury, you know?
Yeah.
That's crazy. At the time, it was the longest and most expensive trial in Orange County history.
A lot of the exhibits of evidence were, sure, things from the crime scene, but most of it was stuff that came from Kraft's apartment with photos of his victims shown slumped over, shown in various pornographic positions. And most of this was supplied by him keeping these trophies. Finally, on August 11th of 1989, the jury found Kraft guilty on 16 counts of murder, 2 counts of sodomy, 1 count of emasculation, and 1 count of driving while intoxicated. 3 months later, he was given his sentence, which was death. In 2000, the California Supreme Court upheld the verdict after it had been appealed.
So today, Kraft is still on death row in San Quentin State Prison. He has continued to maintain his innocence in all crimes. In one interview that he gave, he was asked about the list in his car that is said to be the scorecard. And he said it was just a list of people that he invited to a surprise party for his boyfriend. What a load of bullcrap, you know? He said one column was the names of people I wanted to invite, and the other column were maybes. It was in code so my boyfriend wouldn't recognize it. As the body that was in the car the day he was pulled over, Kraft said that he was a hitchhiker that he had picked up. Kraft said Terry wasn't dead when he was pulled over. He said, "To begin, I did not kill Terry Gambrill, and neither did I kill or assault any of the other persons as the authorities claim. Notwithstanding that, I have been imprisoned since May 14th, 1983.
To be clear, he was pulled over and there was a dead body in his car.
Oh, but he said he wasn't dead when he was pulled over. So
is he insinuating that the police killed him and framed him for this?
I don't know what this guy's insinuating. This has to be one of the most sick people we have ever talked about on this show.
Yeah, he absolutely is, with the brutality of his murders. And I know we went into some detail of some things that happened, but we didn't dive nearly into the most disgusting parts of the things that he did when torturing these victims and assaulting these victims and mutilating their bodies both before and after he killed them. This guy was an absolute monster. He at times was called the highway killer, but there was another highway killer. So he was given this scorecard moniker, to which he said it was just a list of people inviting to a party, which happened to match really closely this list of victims.
Yeah, a little too convenient if you ask me. I mean, look, we've both publicly stated that we don't think there should be a death penalty. We, as Christians, want to give every person an opportunity to, you know, have faith and get their forgiveness and peace. But at the same time, it would not hurt my feelings if California revoked its own policy and executed this guy, because he is sick.
Yeah, if this was on a scale of I don't agree with the death penalty of people I'm going to be upset about being put to death, he's on the meh end for sure.
I know that's probably not okay, and we may catch some flack. But
there are other people who love the death penalty and think that they should all be killed if you kill somebody. So if we lean toward the non-death penalty side, but not losing sleep over this guy not being out there anymore, only convicted of 16 counts of murder, when we think the number could be up in the 60s. So many of these victims not even getting resolution to their cases in court.
We often question, like, do we believe it could really be that many? And with this guy, I have no reservations when I say absolutely.
Yep.
It could very much be almost 70 people murdered by this guy.
And this also isn't a situation where he's confessing and listing people he didn't kill. We see that often with killers trying to take credit for other murders. He's not confessing to anything. These are just crimes that seem like they were probably him.
Yeah. What a way to start 2023. I hope you all are happy.
Now, this was certainly a fascinating case and one that I hadn't learned a lot about before doing the research. And man, I'm just glad I didn't live in California in the 70s and 80s.
I'm glad I don't live there now, but yeah, let alone back then. Did you say there were potentially 20 active serial killers in that time frame?
Yeah, 20.
Yeah,
I know it's a big state, but still.
You know, I think you have more odds of being killed by a serial killer than getting struck by lightning out there.
Yeah. So. It was certainly crazy. A rough time. I'm glad they did catch him and there weren't more victims, but I really wish we could get some sort of resolution for those other victims. 30, 40 years later, I don't think we're going to get that.
Guys, we appreciate you tuning in, starting your 2023 here with us at True Crime Cast. If you want more to listen to from us, don't forget we have a show called Bless Their Hearts where we don't talk about murder. You can also join us on Patreon and get a bonus episode each and every month, as well as ad-free and early episodes only available at patreon.com.
A great way to recommend new cases is in those 5-star reviews. That's a good way to get us to make sure that we notice those messages and add them to the list of future cases. So be sure to look there, and we have a great year planned with more great cases.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.